95.7 Ben FM presents Her Story with Kathy Romano.
Good morning and welcome to Her Story. I'm your host, Kathy Romano. Today's guest struggled with addiction and homelessness for many years. After finally finding a way to sobriety, Megan Cohen decided her mission in life is to end addiction. She founded The Grace Project, a nonprofit that aims to bring hope through acts of kindness to children and adults impacted by sickness, poverty, or addiction. Megan graduated summa cum laude from Purdue University Global and works full-time in addiction and mental health treatment. She's joining me today to share her story. Hi, Megan. Megan?
Hi.
Thanks so much for coming on today.
Of course. It's an honor.
How long have you been sober?
A little over 3 years now.
Take me back to the beginning and tell me how you think your addiction and that part of your life started.
It's hard to say how it started. You know, I can tell you that I definitely was uncomfortable in my own skin growing up, kind of exposed to a lot of chaos from an early age. And really what it came down to was that drugs and alcohol became my solution. You know, I felt uncomfortable. I didn't like the way that my life was. I didn't like myself. And for a little while, I found a solution in drugs and alcohol.
What was your childhood like?
My parents did the best that they could, but, you know, they're human. So there was a lot of chaos in my home. You know, my parents split when I was in elementary school, and it was messy. It was very messy leading up to it. It was messy during it, and it was messy after. My mom remarried, and that marriage wasn't that great either. So, like I said, I mean, they tried the best that they could, but they're human. So me and my sister were definitely exposed to a lot. She handled it one way, and I handled it another way.
So did you see drug addiction as a child?
I didn't. I'm actually the only drug addict in my family. It wasn't one of those learned behaviors. It was just, again, the chaos, not really knowing how to deal with it, not knowing how to deal with my feelings. And initially, it was self-harm. That was how I coped. And then when I got older and I drank for the first time, I found that relief there. And then it switched to drugs, you know, and that was just kind of my way of quieting my mind and not really having to focus on what was going on around me.
How do you go, though, from drinking alcohol to then drugs? Like, was it curiosity? Did you just want to see what it felt like? You know, how do you go from something that is legal, although you were probably doing it at an illegal age, to illegal?
Yeah, it was curiosity. You know, I had people around me as far as like friends that would experiment here and there. They weren't necessarily addicted at this point. I mean, I was just graduating high school the first time that I had tried drugs. And I didn't think that it was ever going to be a problem for me. I thought that I knew enough about addiction. I knew enough about drugs that, like, I would never let myself fall down that path. But what I've learned is that drugs don't discriminate. Anybody can become addicted. And especially when I had the turmoil going on in my life that I did, left me a little extra susceptible to it. So I picked up. I liked it. It was in the beginning, like it was just kind of doing it here and there, or so I thought. But in reality, I mean, I was using right from the start, probably at least 4 days a week, you know, and it just continued to progress, but it was never something that I thought was going to happen. And like I said, the people around me that were doing it too, a lot of them ended up, it was just a phase for them. They were in college, they were just partying, they were experimenting, and I thought I was doing the same, you know, but my journey ended up looking a lot different.
So when did you know it was a problem and it was an addiction?
So the first time that I knew it was an addiction, I actually, I tried to stop using because the person that I was dating at the time had gotten arrested. And, you know, I was like, oh, well, if he can't use, I won't use either, you know, because I was just so in love. And my friend called me later that day and asked if I wanted to go out. I was like, oh, no, like I have the flu. I'm just going to stay in. He had asked me if I used that day and I said no. And he started laughing and was like, oh, you're withdrawing. You know, and that was the first time I was like, oh, my gosh. And I realized because I tried to say, no, I'm not. There's no way. And he was like, all right, well, you know, come get high with us and you're going to feel better. And he was right. That was kind of another big difference between somebody who is addicted and a normal person. Instead of thinking, okay, I have to get through this sickness, never touch this stuff again, so to never feel this way again, I just have to make sure that I get high every single day. And so when I had that realization that like I had become addicted, it actually, you know, made things kind of take off even more.
Because you knew if you continued to do it, you wouldn't feel like that, or you thought
right.
that.
Right.
What was your drug of choice?
So initially it was Percocet. Obviously, like things progressed. So eventually it became heroin. And then in the end, it was heroin and crack.
And you talk about getting high with friends. Is that how it always was? I would imagine with addiction that you end up alone doing it.
Oh, yeah. It started out with friends and it ended up very lonely. You know, I was very isolated from everyone, friends, family. The end of my journey took me to a lot of different places, being homeless in different places and being completely alone there. Something that starts out as fun and everybody can afford their own drugs and everybody's not necessarily doing bad things to get them. You know, you can maintain those relationships, but at a certain point, I was living against what my morals and values were, the things that I was doing to get money, to make sure that I could get high. I wasn't somebody that you would want to be around. So slowly, I started losing all of my friends. And I had drug friends that aren't actually friends, but just people that I used with here and there. But for the most part, in the end, it's just very lonely. It's you and the drugs.
Talk about being homeless.
I've had a lot of experience being homeless. I was homeless out in California. I was homeless in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Florida. The way that that happened was I had been to treatment so many times. And it got to a point where barely any treatment centers in Pennsylvania would take me. And I had good insurance at the time. I was under my dad's insurance. So I always was going to like these nice places that were out of state. But the problem was I wouldn't make it through the detox. So I would find somebody that was from the area, talk to them, find out where the closest place was that I could find drugs. And I would leave and I would end up out there and I wouldn't want to tell my family that I left. Or I would start getting, I would find what I want and I was comfortable in that. The drugs were good or whatever it was. And I would just stay. And I would stay stuck for a while until I had enough. And then I'd go to treatment somewhere else. And I kept repeating this pattern. Every time it would lead me back to Philadelphia. And that was where I was most comfortable and where, as horrible as it sounds, I was most comfortable being homeless in. It's hard to explain. I mean, all the different places that I was homeless in, like, they're all different. Some are more violent. Some are just more like open air drug market. Some is like kind of a collection of the two. But, you know, things happen. And every single time, like, there was just more trauma added to like what I was going through. And that just led me to kind of want to quiet that down even more. So it became this vicious cycle for me.
Were you actually like living on the street?
Yeah. So there was a couple times where I had a car to live in. Or there was abandoned houses that I could sleep in, or I could stay with this person or stay with that person. But in all of the places that I listed, I slept on the streets as well. So sometimes you can't find anywhere to go, and that's where you end up. And the last time around when I was homeless out in Philadelphia, I didn't have a car because I had a thing with totaling cars because I was using. So I had nothing. And I would sleep basically wherever I would pass out. Sometimes that was the sidewalk. Sometimes that was an abandoned house. Sometimes it was an alley, but it was wherever I fell asleep.
What was your low point or your rock bottom?
I would say realizing that I had nobody, and understandably so, and realizing that I was repeating the same pattern. I had to do something different or my life wasn't going to change. And I got to the point where I wanted to die. I was begging God for some sort of intervention to either help me get on the right path to get this right and like to get sober and have a good life, or to just let me die. That was a new low, because despite all of the feelings that I had in the past, all the other times that I thought I hit my bottom, there was nothing like this last time around where I finally was just like, please God, like I can't do this anymore. Please intervene. Actually getting to that point of not caring about whether I lived or died, and realizing that the things that I did care about, the state of mind that I was in, I barely cared. And me prior to drugs and alcohol, I'm a very caring person. I'm very family oriented. So all of those things that were super important to me and things that I lived for growing up, they didn't matter anymore. Coming to that realization, that was really scary, and then put me deeper into that, like, I have nothing to live for.
You talk about losing all the people in your life. I saw a piece on NBC 10 and you talked about robbing your grandmother.
Yeah, that was the main events that happened that kind of led me to this, because that was right before. I mean, that was right before I got treatment this last time around and prior to my last stint being homeless in Philadelphia. And that was what plummeted me, because I broke into my grandmother's house and she woke up while I was in there. My grandmother is a saint. She doesn't curse. She's just an amazing woman. And I'm hearing her cursing and she's scared and she's digging around and probably looking for her gun. When my grandfather passed away, like, it was not easy to get her to go to the shooting range to learn how to shoot that thing. And like, here I am listening to her in another room digging around her drawer. I wanted to tell her that she was okay. I wanted to tell her that it was me, but I wasn't willing to give up what I had taken because I needed to get high. It was a new low for me. And I waited till she went back downstairs and I went back out the window and I called my mom. I went down the street and I called my mom and said, you know, it was me. Let grandma know that it was me in the house, you know, but I'm not going back. It was a big moment for me because I finally, like, I admit to my family what I was. I showed myself that, like, because I used to be able to lie to myself and be like, oh, you still care about your family. But here I was in a situation where I could choose between giving my grandmother peace of mind and me being sick or stealing from her, allowing her to feel scared, allowing her to feel hurt and betrayed so that I could get high. And, you know, that was the path that I took. So it was very eye-opening for me and helped me find my way to my bottom, get to that point where, you know, I didn't want to keep digging anymore and I didn't want to live like that anymore. So, you know, it was a very, very pivotal moment. I'm so blessed to say that our relationship is amazing today. But there was definitely, even when I first got sober, there was a period of time where I didn't think that there was ever going to be a way to fix that and fix what I did.
How did you finally get clean?
I actually called my mom, told her that, you know, I was ready for her to come pick me up. And I knew she was going to turn me in. I had warrants out at this point. I had violation of parole. I had new charges. But again, I was done and praying for something to happen. And as I'm like constantly praying for this, I encountered a woman out there that kind of restored a little bit of hope for me. And that gave me what I needed to find the courage to call my mom and say, okay, like I'm ready and kind of turn it over to God and whatever happens, happens. So I did. And my mom came and she turned me in. I had to go to the hospital to get medically cleared to even go to the jail because my feet were so torn up from being homeless. They had to actually medically clear me. I go there and the sheriffs come in and they took me. It was just a different feeling of peace and this acceptance of like, all right, I'm not going to try to manipulate my way out of this one. I'm going to let this play out the way that it's supposed to. I ended up going on drug court. I went from being released from the jail directly into a treatment center. And then when I got done treatment, I went directly into a recovery house and I did outpatient care from all different levels. I got additional trauma treatment. I was blessed. Drug court did a lot for me because it provided me with extra resources. And I kind of made this deal with myself that not only was I going to do everything that was required of me from drug court, but also whatever like was required of me from a 12-step program. In a sense, I kind of thought like I was going to prove everyone wrong. Like, look, I'm going to do all of this stuff and I'm still going to get high, you know, because I can't stay sober. Somebody like me can't get sober. And that's not what happened. I did absolutely everything and my life started to change and started coming to terms with like what my past was and finding acceptance in that and realized the only way that I can really make up for that is living a meaningful life today, every day going forward and not causing any more harm and trying to help as many people as I can. By kind of coupling all of those things together, finding a purpose, finding my passion, getting treatment on the mental end, getting treatment for the addiction, I started finding happiness and I started creating a life for myself that I wasn't willing to give up for drugs and alcohol.
What was that act of kindness from the stranger that helped you reach a turning point in your life?
So a woman came up to me on the street and she grabbed the back of my shirt right before that. I actually just come out of an abandoned house. And when I was in the abandoned house, it was the same thing, begging God, you know, give me a sign and, you know, intervene in some way. And so this woman grabs me and I turn around thinking that somebody was trying to rob me. And another lady comes running over and she was like, no, she wants to talk to you, because the woman who grabbed me spoke primarily Spanish. This woman's translating and she's like, you know, something's drawing her to you. She's been watching you. She feels like you don't belong out here and she wants to know what your story is. And I was completely transparent. I robbed my grandmother. I'm on heroin and crack. I have warrants, and telling her exactly what I was at that given time. Despite all of that, this woman who doesn't know me and like can't even communicate with me wanted to bring me into her house and give me clean clothes, let me take a shower and warm food. When I tell this story, I always say, I don't recommend doing this. I don't know what she was thinking. You know, my nonprofit's out in Kensington every week and we don't bring people home with us. We offer them resources. We give them food. We give them first aid and hygiene supplies, and we will take them to treatment if they want to go. Because the reality is, I don't know what it was that kept me from trying to rob that woman or doing anything to harm her. But she did. She brought me into her house and the woman who was translating didn't come in with us. And she did everything she said she was going to, you know, pointed up to her shower and left clothes on the sink for me. And I came downstairs and she had a warm plate of food waiting for me. Before I left, me and her kind of looked into each other's eyes. We both started crying. I don't know exactly what that was, but like my best guess is that was God. Because it restored something in me. And I was kind of like, okay, this is sort of a direct answer to my prayers, you know, and it just gave me that little bit of faith that like there was something greater at work. And that was the night that I called my mom and I told her that I was ready to get out of there.
It's amazing that there's people like that woman in this world.
Yeah, amazing.
How do you maintain your sobriety?
I mean, it's a lot of things. It's more than just going to meetings, getting therapy, not picking up The way that I live my life is completely centered around staying sober. Like I mentioned earlier, living a life where I'm trying to help other people and like I'm causing no harm. Because then I lay my head down at night and I'm completely okay with who I am. So there's no guilt or shame attached to anything because that was always like a big trigger for me. Helping other people on their recovery journeys keeps it fresh for me. You know, I'm constantly reminded of what the misery is of being stuck in active addiction. So it keeps it green and it reminds me that's something I don't want to go back to. Staying active in a 12-step fellowship, reaching out to other people, having a support network so that when I am struggling, you know, I have people that I can talk to and I can bounce things off of, and being very self-aware. You know, when I have a lot going on, like there's some weeks that just because I have a lot of stress, like I won't go out to Kensington. I'll let the volunteers run it. You know, and that's something that it's super important because it can creep up on you. Despite how much work you do, whenever you stop doing the work and you stop living the right way, and then you couple that with like a lot of stress, a lot of times like our brain tells us go pick up. So I just make sure that I'm very aware of those things and I go above and beyond to avoid putting myself in any situations that are going to lead me to pick up.
And do you keep a picture of yourself that your mother took of you during your addiction?
I do. I have it in my phone. And after like a few months goes by, sometimes like I'll resave it so I don't have to scroll all the way to the top to look at it. It's a constant reminder. Anytime that I think that sounds good and sounds like a good way out, you know, going back to old ways, I can just look at it. And, you know, it's cool because I used to look at it a lot more. I don't have to look at it as much anymore, but I keep it just because it keeps it fresh for me.
So you mentioned a few times going into Kensington with your nonprofit. Talk about the Grace Project.
Yeah, so the Grace Project actually wasn't something that I planned. So the night that I had asked my mom to pick me up from Kensington, the last night that I was out there, I asked her if she could bring water and food for the people that I was out there with, because at that point I had finally experienced what true hunger felt like and true thirst, because all the other times that I was homeless, it was just different. This last time around was a lot different. So she did. And it was a big moment for my mom because she was handing it out with me and she was talking to some of the other people out there. And for so long, she separated me from everybody else out there and be like, why are you out there with these people? You were raised better and you're better. And she started talking to them. And one of the girls started telling my mom her story. And, you know, she was crying to her. That was like the night my mom realized that every single person out there is just like me. I'm not different than them. Yeah, some of them come from bad backgrounds, but like they're good people. They're just sick. Or their story is very similar to mine, but everyone out there is somebody to somebody. While I was away, her and one of her friends had gone out and brought sandwiches out there. And then like COVID hit, so she didn't do it again. And when I was around a year sober, she texted me. And I had said that night to like, I'm like, one day I'm going to come out here and do this and like help people, you know, but I didn't necessarily know if I meant it because I didn't know if I could stay sober. And so my mom texted me around a year sober and she's like, hey, if I wanted to bring some food out to Kensington, where would I go? And I'm like, Mom, you're not going out there by yourself. You don't know that area. I'll go with you and I'll see if some of my friends from the program want to come. And I made a post on my Facebook. It blew up. I was getting tons of messages, tons of shares, tons of comments. Me and my mom talked about it and we're like, let's do it at least every other week, if not every week, but we're going to shoot for every single week. I kind of had this like internal conflict and I was like, well, I don't want to be posting like, oh, look what I'm doing on my page. So like, I want to make a separate page for this thing that we're doing. So it's not like, hey, look at me, look what I'm doing. And people can follow it and, you know, they can get involved if they want to. So I thought long and hard about a name. I came up with the Grace Project and I make this separate page. And then that starts taking off and people want to start donating money. And again, I had only about a year sober at this time. My vision had grown. When I saw how many people wanted to get behind it, I was like, okay, we can do a lot more with this. I don't want it to just be addiction focused. You know, I want it to be hope focused. And people lose hope for many different reasons. So I started really thinking on that. And I was like, you know, on top of this, I want this to live on. If God forbid I ever do pick back up, I don't want full control of these funds that are donated. I want them to be monitored and I want this to live on and like go into somebody else's hands and to be removed from it. So I incorporated as a nonprofit with no experience, no idea what I was doing, but more so to protect the integrity and protect the vision of the Grace Project. And it's just continued to grow from there. So, you know, we go out to Kensington once a week on Thursday nights. You know, we bring out supplies. We try to get people connected with resources and into treatment. That program in itself has turned into a lot more. We have people that call us from all over. for help with their loved ones, whether it's asking if I can talk to their loved one and try to get them to get help or to help find placement in treatment and kind of get some guidance on, okay, what treatment centers are good or where can this person go? Or so it's kind of become more than just us being out in Kensington, but more so connecting people to the resources that they need to get help. And then we have two programs for kids. We have our Give a Little Hope program, and that's for kids impacted by poverty, addiction, or sickness. They're nominated. They only have to qualify in one of those categories, and we select them at random, and then we give them a whole day tailored to them and one of their parents. So it's actually, it's not just for the kid, it's for their parent too, because the ones that we've done so far, the joy that the parents have from seeing their kids have a whole day just for them and based off their interests. We pick them up in a limo, we take them somewhere fun, spend the day with them, and just make them feel special, get them a couple of presents. It's something that's rewarding for both the child and the parent. And then we have our Hope for the Holidays program that I think we sponsored like 26 kids. And then this past year, we more than doubled that. And we also provided Christmas trees and some decorations for some families and Christmas meals. So we're steadily growing. We're doing the best that we can. We're holding off on adding more programs right now just because it's a lot for me with, you know, working full time as well and trying to keep these things going. You know, down the line, we want to do more. Our goal is to just kind of help as many people as we can and give hope to as many people as we can.
So you're working full time. Talk about what you do for a living.
Yeah, so I actually just switched jobs. I'm now director of business development for a treatment center that is going to be opening in Southampton in Bucks County. I've been working in the field since a few months after Grace Project started, actually, I got into the substance abuse field. So basically what my job is, it's very similar to what I do a lot of the times with Grace Project. It's connecting people with resources, knowing where somebody can go based on how things look for them financially or how their insurance is, what their needs are. Do they have the mental health aspect in it as well? Is there like an eating disorder? So having knowledge of a bunch of different treatment centers and being able to connect people to the best fit for them. And then just all community relations. So if there's like events in the community, you know, deciding, hey, we should sponsor this, going and meeting other people who do the same thing. So it's a lot of networking and a lot of just community relations and resources.
Do you look for volunteers for the Grace Project, or is there a way the public can help support your cause?
Yeah, absolutely. Our website has a volunteer form. Basically, we have everybody do that, even if they're just going to come out and drop food off in Kensington. And we have our volunteer coordinator reach out and kind of get a little bit more information. If somebody, because we've had people that, you know, they're not comfortable going out to Kensington, they want to be involved kind of more behind the scenes. And that's something that I definitely need. You know, I need people that have experience with nonprofits, that have different skills that they can bring to the table and help me make things run smoothly on the back end. So we're always looking for that. We're always kind of screening volunteers saying like, hey, where's your experience? And, you know, do you want to be more involved? So it's something that we're always open to and always looking for.
People struggle every day with addiction. If there was one bit of advice that you could give someone who is currently struggling right now, what would you say to them?
I would tell them to ask somebody for help that's done it before them. A big part of it is the hopelessness. I didn't think I was capable of being sober. And I think that a lot of people deal with that. And then if it's not that, then it's fear. You know, there's fear of failure and fear of success. And I struggled with that too. I didn't want to build things back up just for them to crumble again. But at the same time, like I didn't want to give sobriety a shot just to fail. So there was a lot that goes into it. And I needed people to guide me on how to do this thing. So getting vulnerable and saying to somebody like, hey, I need help. Most people that are in recovery, they want to help the next person find their way as well, because they've experienced both ends of it. So finding somebody that has lived experience and asking them for guidance is key. There's hope for anybody. If you're still breathing, you can get sober. You know, it took me 71 attempts in treatment, and that's just inpatient and detox, being in and out of jail, tons of different recovery houses. It took me a lot of tries, but what it came down to, I could have gotten it the first time if I would have just listened to somebody else who had done it and taken suggestions and given myself a chance. So really anybody can do this.
71 times.
Yeah. Yep.
But you know what? Thankfully, you didn't give up, because there's plenty of people that do and they end up in a much different situation than you're in.
Right.
Megan, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
For more information about the Grace Project, you can visit their website, teamgraceproject.org. And if you missed any part of today's interview, Megan's podcast will be available on our website, 957benfm.com, tomorrow morning. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Kathy Romano. Have a great rest of your weekend.
This has been Her Story with Kathy Romano. Her Story is produced by WBEN-FM in Philadelphia and airs weekly or on demand on your mobile device. Listen or subscribe at 957benfm.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.